Hello, my name's Bernadette Russell, and welcome to episode 5 of How to Be Hopeful, a podcast all about hope, how to find it, and how to keep hold of it once you've found it. This week, I'm very pleased to be speaking to Stella Duffy, who's the director of Fun Palaces. I was really excited to speak to Stella because one of the positives that have come out of this extraordinary period of lockdown is an explosion of creativity. Suddenly, many of us have had time to do the things that we've always wished we'd have time to do. It's transformed lots of people into artists who wouldn't normally identify as such, and people have had time to be creative for the first time in a long time, or ever. From children painting rainbows and sticking them up in windows, from people transforming their entire windows into art galleries, people trying out pottery and baking and gardening and singing and dancing for the very first time or for a long time. It's been wonderful to see people enjoying being creative and expressing themselves in this way. Stella is a long-time champion of this, and the tagline for her organisation is "Everyone an artist, everyone a scientist." So I very much looked forward to seeing her and hearing what she had to say. Cool. So first of all, could you just tell me your name and how you are in this moment?
My name is Stella Duffy, and how I am is uncertain. The last 2 days I felt really quite at peace and like, oh yeah, okay, maybe I can do this. And last week had been really difficult. And then today again I thought, oh, I don't know if I can do this or not. So I'm currently in a state of uncertainty.
Yeah, it feels super important to for us all to be honest about how we're actually doing.
Absolutely, and you know, when people say how are you, I'm actually answering at the moment.
Yeah.
Rather than going, yeah, fine, because I'm not fine. No one's fine. Well, no, I've spoken to a couple of people who are actually really enjoying lockdown. They like the aloneness, they like the quiet, they're healthy, so for them it feels okay. So there are a few, but I think for most of us, you know, there's a huge amount of existential anxiety going on, perfectly understandably, and it's great to acknowledge that.
Yeah, I think that's very astute. I think people are answering honestly, and I feel that people are listening to the answer as well.
And there's almost an interest, you know, rather than just saying hi, how are you for something to say, people are almost saying it like they genuinely want to know, because we're all in a very different boat, and some people are in quite different boats. I'm really well aware that I'm not a key worker or an NHS worker. Mm-hmm. And I'm in a very different boat to those people who are doing 12-hour shifts and literally putting their lives on the line. Yeah. I haven't lost anyone recently, so I'm not in grief, which is great. So, you know, I have two friends who lost their life partners just before all of this started, and they are grieving alone. Not to mention the people, you know, who are losing people now. So all of that is going on around us. So, and even for those of us for whom it's not personally happening, it's really happening strongly around us in a way that quite often we can be going through quite difficult things, but we feel like we're the only one. And right now, it's kind of obvious that none of us is the only one.
Yeah, you're right. It's an incredible, in every sense of that word, shared experience, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. And you know, we haven't had anything like this since, I don't know, the plague, the previous ones, or maybe the Spanish flu after the First World War.
Yeah.
But we didn't have the internet. We didn't have the current society we have. We didn't have the news that told us how bad it was, however much we believe the news, but we didn't have that connection either that told us daily, you know, what was going on.
Yeah.
So this is all new.
It's very interesting. I'm sort of really interested in trying to be very honest with all of it, because the interconnectedness that social media and the internet provides is both wonderful and terrible.
Yeah.
the news is both uplifting and horrifying. It's all of that stuff, and I feel genuinely grateful to be learning stuff. I've got family that are, you know, working in A&E and stuff, and I know that's a different experience. But it does feel like, although we're in different boats, we're in the same sea and kind of looking at each other's boats, to stretch your metaphor.
And I really think that we are in the same sea, but it's really useful to acknowledge the different boats.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe they're rafts, maybe they're just life rafts, you know, who knows. Yeah. But I know that whatever my bad day is like, I'm not doing a 12-hour shift in a hospital and not getting to see this lovely blue sky that I can see out my window.
Yeah.
And I'm very aware of that, very aware of the privilege of being able to carry on in some ways my normal life.
Yeah.
And hanging on to that, not in a kind of Pollyanna way, but just in a, well, this is also my truth. It is also lovely weather, and I get to enjoy it.
Yes, it's complicated, and it's important to acknowledge the complexity, I think, of it as well. What I wanted, if it's all right with you, kind of wanted to talk to you about in particular. So one of the sort of highlights, headlines, if you like, for me, sort of really beautiful points of light in all of this is the creative response and the artistic response, and that not solely from the, if you like, professional artistic community, but
absolutely,
the creative response as a whole. And I just thought you'd be perfect person to speak to about that because of the kind of work you do with Fun Palaces. And I wondered if you would you be able to talk a little bit about that, just so people know from your words.
So I did a lovely thing with Greenwich Libraries yesterday, which was an hour-long Twitter Q&A. And when I was asked what Fun Palaces was, I probably gave the best answer I ever have, in that I said, I think it's more than one thing. And I normally do say that, but I don't normally say that up front. So let's say up front, it's more than one thing.
Mm-hmm.
On one hand, Fun Palaces is an organisation that I co-founded with Sarah Jane Rawlings in 2013, based on a never-built idea that Joan Littlewood, the theatre director, and Cedric Price, the architect, had of one building to house all the arts, all the sciences, accessible to all. It was going to be an actual physical space in the East End of London, and they never got the money together in the 60s or the 70s to make it happen. But actually, when we sort of revived this idea in 2013, Sarah Jane has worked a lot more than I have in formal arts organisations, in learning and participation and as a producer, whereas I've been a maker and an artist and freelance my entire working life. And I started working in my late teens, and I'm 57.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never once had a proper job, in inverted commas. never had sick pay either. So, you know, people always go, oh, wow, imagine being freelance all your life. I'm like, And then have two cancers and try and cope without sick pay, which I've done. It's rubbish. But, you know, still I'm here and that's great. Anyway, we wanted to recreate this idea of a thing that never happened, that sort of remained an idea. But we don't need any more buildings. And I, you know what, if this virus is showing us anything, it's that it's people we need to focus on, not buildings.
Yes.
And so with Fun Palaces in 2013, to start the first annual weekend, because it's also an annual weekend, we said, look, use what you've got. Use the park, use the school, use the library, use the church hall, use the scout hut, use your back garden, use your front garden, use the bit of green space in front of the estate, use the car park, and use that as your place to create a local community event. And the other thing that we did that I think is sort of based on the 60s idea, but much more ours, is we said it doesn't need to be professional artists or scientists or tech people or digital people or sports people. All of those people are welcome. And if they wanted to come and bring their skills, that's great. But our focus is on the ordinary, everyday people in the community who rarely get a light shone upon them, who are doing amazing things day in, day out, and always have been. And I think, again, this crisis has shown us very clearly that there are some phenomenal people who have just been doing phenomenal stuff all along, getting on with it quietly, just making a difference in their communities. And once this came along, they went, oh, okay, we'll do that then as well. We'll look after those people. And we wanted to acknowledge those people. And sometimes they are professional artists and sometimes they're not. And sometimes they're people who may have, you know, enjoyed arts or culture or sciences when they were younger, and then, I don't know, they had kids or they had a job or something went wrong in their life, and now in their later life they've come back to wanting to share it. Or sometimes they're 15-year-olds going, I don't have an official skill, but I could teach you this. So after trial and error, because we've never known what fun classes really is, and it changes every year, and it's an annual event, in that communities get together and co-create their own fun palace at the first weekend of October every year. But every year we learn, we the people who run it, so there's three of us in our central team in London with a couple of others, one's on maternity leave, one's outside of us and he comes in and does things on contract, and seven ambassadors around the country, and we're all 2 days a week. So, you know, all together, that's, I don't know, 11 people when Kirsty's not off on maternity leave, all 2 days a week. We ended up creating this thing that 500,000 people or more have taken part in. Yeah. And that very much says that culture is what your community says it is. And your community is going to think differently than the community around the corner. Or the community in the Highlands is going to think differently than the community in Northern Ireland. And because we now have ambassadors in Northern Ireland and the Highlands and the Central Belt of Scotland and in Cornwall and Sheffield and North Wales, they're also teaching us what that local culture is, and it's going to be different than my culture in South London.
Yeah.
And some, there'll be some crossovers and some places where they're very different. And so Fun Palaces is this original idea. It's also the annual weekend, but more than anything, it's what people do when they get together to come together, maybe in May, maybe in September, to co-create the thing that becomes the Fun Palace on the weekend. And we've always said it's way more about the process than the product. And if people end up going, you know, on the Friday before Fun Palace's weekend, oh, no, we're not going to do it. We actually got everything we needed out of having six meetings and lots of cups of tea. That's fine with us.
Yeah.
Seriously, it's never been about the product. Yeah. And very early on, I had a conversation with a senior arts leader who said to me, yes, but Stella, how are you going to guarantee the excellence?
Oh, dear.
I said, I'm not, but I am going to guarantee the excellence of engagement. Yeah. Because if we say to people across the land, and it's beyond the UK, there's been fun palaces in loads of other countries, if we say we trust you to lead in your community and we'll help you, we'll print posters for you, we'll do national press for you, we'll write a press template for you, we'll write a letter to your MP for you, we'll support you with a 2-hour phone call if you don't know how to upload a photo, and believe me, we have done that.
Yeah, I'm sure.
You know, we'll help you to do what you want to do. What they want to do is always phenomenal, and it's always right for their community because they know their community far better than I do.
Yeah.
So that's what it is. It's a load of different things and it changes every year and we never quite know. But at base, it's saying that, Benedict, you know yourself better than I could ever know you.
Yeah.
I know myself better than someone else could know me. I know where I live. I know the people nearby me. I know my, you know, my closests. And they're the ones that I can support best. And we've so seen that. You know, all the mutual aid groups, all the local groups that have got together. We can see this really clearly, and it didn't take organising from a central bureau. It was just people going, I think my neighbour might need some support. I'm going to put a note through their door and say, do you need me to get you anything in the supermarket?
Yeah.
And that's the core of what we've been doing for 7 years.
That, I mean, I thought of you and Fun Palaces at the very beginning of seeing the sort of beautiful flurry of WhatsApp groups popping up and community groups popping up and community kitchens and community stores, etc., because it's the same model, isn't it? There's a sort of hyper-locality that really works. But it's absolutely also because people feel like they can join in. And I was very gratified, as I'm sure you were, to see what I'd always suspected was that people are yearning to join in. They're yearning to help. They're desperate to. All they really need is an invitation, which is gentle and friendly enough, isn't it? Yeah. So, amazing.
And I think gentleness is really key.
Yeah.
There, because you can't force joining in. People need to feel like they could, you know, I don't know, join in for 2 hours, maybe not four, if they don't have time to join in for four. They need to feel like they can give what they can give. And I think, and we've always said that with Fun Palaces, and heartbreakingly, because of this crisis, it's shown up really obviously that letting people give what they feel able to makes all the difference.
Oh, yeah. It was beautiful. I mean, some really incredibly beautiful things have happened, I think, which we'll sort of, generally, I think, which hopefully we'll have a chance to talk about later. But just before we go on back into that, do you have, this might be impossible to answer, but I just wondered if you had a sort of few kind of Julie Andrews type favourite things list of things that might have happened or you've seen or witnessed during Fun Palaces. I'm sure you've got loads, and that's like asking someone to pick a favourite book.
And sort of asking me to pick my favourite child,
really.
Yes,
I'm sorry, it's cruel.
Okay, but here's an example, and I think, you know how it's all gone quiet about Brexit now? Like all we heard for 5 years was Brexit, and now we don't hear it at all.
Yeah.
So one of the Fun Palaces makers who's made a Fun Palace every year is French, and working with other colleagues, some of whom were from other European nations. And very early on, in our first year, they said, can we join in? We're not British. We work here doing specific work that involves them being in touch with other nations while they're working. We don't necessarily feel very integrated and very much part of community. And we don't know how to join in. And so we said, God, yes, of course, you're ideal. Do what you want, and then help them to. And to see those people, so Corinne is one of these people, and she's led on the Fun Palace for years now. And Corinne has written really beautifully for us about how she realised that she too could make a difference in integrating, that maybe if the local people weren't going to stand there with open arms, she could be the person with open arms. And that made such a difference. And I often cite Corinne's input into Fun Palaces, basically as somebody that I've learned so much from. Mm. How do I support people who don't necessarily feel comfortable and welcome? And all of this was happening as the Brexit stuff got bigger and bigger in the past 5 years, to feel not only welcome, but like they too can lead in their community. And one of the things that she said very early on is, I remember her telling me that they had gone out in the street, her and some colleagues, like with a clipboard, and asking local people what they thought community was. And somebody said to her, goodness, you know, you're not even from here and you're interested in community. And they were pleased. They were pleased to be able to make a stand and say, yes, we are. And yes, we are. And, you know, as she said, she's gotten to know people and neighbours that she wouldn't have known otherwise.
Yeah.
So that's one we often talk about, the libraries of Devon from Libraries Unlimited, and how they just all jumped into it and decided they would make it theirs. Fun Palaces in Orkney and the Western Isles, you know, places that I've never been to.
I have friends there, actually, Stella.
Oh,
so,
really?
Yes, I do.
And places that, you know, I'd love to visit that have made Fun Palaces. And then, so another one in London, Boundary Estate, where... their estate is very mixed. It's got white working class and yes, it's got second, third generation British Asian families. But because it's where it is in Tower Hamlets, it's also got the kind of people who can afford to buy a one bedroom flat for £800,000.
Oh my goodness!
So it's got a real mix, and that community making a Fun Palace year on year, and that Fun Palace growing. And those people coming together in a different way. And they tell us, you know, and I can't see it from outside because I don't know their community and I don't live in it. But they've told us that it's made a difference to them and to how their community works together. And in fact, they won a local award from Tower Hamlets this year, which is really exciting.
It's kind of circling.
Sorry, Han.
I was just going to say, it's circling back to what we were saying about the importance of... And the sort of beauty of a shared experience is just that simple, isn't it?
Absolutely. And also, one of the things I really like is when somebody new says they'd like to make a Fun Palace, but they've never done anything like that before, I can point them to various resources, and we have loads on the website, and they're also open source. People can use them for anything they want. They don't have to make a Fun Palace with it, though we like it, but they don't have to. Mm-hmm. But actually, it's much more useful if I put them in touch with one of our other makers. And, you know, so... somebody in Sheffield might know what is useful for... So Pitsmore Adventure Playground in Sheffield has made a Fun Palace several times. They'd know what another adventure playground could maybe do in a different place. Or maybe the ones in rural Northern Ireland could support the ones in rural Central Belt Scotland because they have a similar rural ethos. Mm. And so what we've discovered is that putting those types of people in touch is so much more useful than us pretending we know everything, because we don't, but also much more useful for them, because then it's somebody who's a bit more like them and understands their community a bit more from their own experience.
Do you know what that sounds like? That sounds like sort of a Fun Palaces version of twinning, you know, town twinning.
Yeah, well, we've talked about that a lot, but the only reason we haven't done it is it would involve more time than we've got, but also more planning than I would want to put into it, because I can't second guess who's going to be helpful. But I can say, look, there's this person who's done something similar to what you want to do, and there's this person who's done nothing like it, and where they live is totally different, but having had a conversation with you, I think you might get on.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you're doing it anyway, even if it's not, you know, sounds like twinning, that sort of connectivity is going on anyway, which is really lovely.
Absolutely. And what's really cool is when I just get the hell out of the way and they talk to each other. No, seriously.
Yeah, I mean, I hear you.
Our role is to get out of the way, right? Yeah. Help people get together and then get out of the way. And they talk to each other on Twitter, or they're talking to each other on our Makers Facebook page. And then it's, you know, all we ever want to do is make introductions and spend it. We spend a lot of time saying yes. You know, people ring us up and go, can I make a Fun Palace? I don't have a venue. And we go, yes, of course. Why don't we use our social media to see if we can help you get a venue? Or I've got a venue, but I don't know anybody. Well, yes, of course, we'll find some people that could make a Fun Palace with you.
Yeah.
A lot of what we do is just say yes. And so many people have never been told yes.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they're just, and we live in a culture that tells us no all the time from the age of three, because at about three or four, when you're still calling the kitchen table a cave and an elephant and a mountain, mm-hmm. that's great. But when you're 10 and you're calling it a cave and an elephant and a mountain, you start getting told, no, I don't think so. Let's be sensible. And I think it's no surprise that Sarah Jane and I and Kirsty, in fact, from Fun Palaces, all have worked with improvisation companies, mm-hmm. and we care about improvisation. Improvisation is saying yes and. It's accept and build, and that's all we've ever done with Fun Palaces.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I've been thinking, writing a lot about how, I mean, I know it's a thing that a lot of people have thought about, but to what extent most adults are removed, their permission to play is taken away.
Absolutely.
And it has a sort of profoundly negative effect. And I think because we're lucky enough to work in the creative industries, we've been allowed to play for longer. So we can sometimes forget that actually access to play isn't most adults' experience.
Absolutely. I'm fine, I should say that, because I'm studying psychotherapy and currently writing an essay on psychoanalytic views on creativity from Freud to Klein and then to Winnicott, and Winnicott's book Playing and Reality, in which he talks about the psychotherapeutic relationship as being a play relationship between the therapist and the client. He talks about play being the relationship between the carer and the infant, and that when we lose that ability to play is when we lose our creativity, and so often the playing ability is shut down.
It's, I mean, Einstein spoke about it as well. Lots of scientists, I think, understood that. It's a very rich scene, that whole treasuring play and reclaiming play or gifting play to other people.
Although I would say that I'm not certain the arts sector is totally brilliant at it, because the minute you start bringing in all the money, which, you know, is important, and you start going, oh my God, well, we can't play for too long, so we've got to make a decision here, which is why, you know, very early on people said to us, well, aren't you paying the local people to make their Fun Palace? And we were like, nah, A, we're never going to get enough money to say yes to as many people as we want to, and B, if we did have funds, I'd have to decide who was going to make a good enough Fun Palace.
Yeah, it's different.
And I'd have to judge them. So people make Fun Palaces entirely on their own. 70% of them don't need extra funding, because all they're doing, yes, of course, they're using their time, but they're using their time and their own expertise. They're sharing their own skills with each other. And just to go back one thing, one of the things that excites us about asking people to share their own skills is that people who sometimes might think they don't have anything to share, you know, it's pretty easy to say to someone, okay, well, what could you teach somebody? And what did you teach your grandkid? Or what did you teach your nana? Or what did you teach your mate at school? And everyone's got something.
Oh, absolutely.
And when we're teaching each other, like just you and me, we talk differently. Mm. You know, you show me how to, I don't know, move my hands because you're teaching me how to draw. Mm-hmm. And instead of looking into a stranger's eyes and having that scary conversation with a stranger, we're looking at our hands. You're teaching me how to crochet. We're looking at our hands. You're teaching me how to weld. We're looking at our hands. And when we do that, we begin to speak to each other differently, and it allows conversation to grow slowly.
It's really beautiful. And again, I think circling back to the recent events, one of the positives, I know there's lots of terrible losses connected to the pandemic, but one of the positives is that it's, I think of it like kind of weather in football, bus stop conversations. There is a starting point for a conversation which people yearn for and then can move on from. And that conversation often, how are you doing? How are you doing? Leads to, do you need anything? Can I help you? You know, so it's a sort of gift, I think, to facilitate conversation as you do so beautifully.
I've had a lot more conversations. And for somebody who does what I do for my living, I'm really not very good at talking to strangers. I find it scary. I find it daunting. I'm really good at performing and turning it on, and I can turn it on. But my truth is, and actually I normally say this if I make a big speech now as well, I'm always petrified beforehand, and I'm always feeling very vulnerable and very exposed. And I think we're all a bit vulnerable and exposed right now, and so that's almost taken as a given, which means that those of us who are particularly anxious about being vulnerable and exposed are almost feeling it even slightly less, because we know other people, we know it's not that unusual right now.
No, no.
And I think that's quite helpful.
Yeah. It's very liberating as well, because everybody's talking about feeling vulnerable, feeling sad. My sister, my sister's a psychiatric nurse, and although she's noticed an uptick in mental health challenges for people, she's also noticed that the conversation's much easier. Just saying, "I feel so sad."
That's amazing.
I know. Really sort of beautiful. Both alarming and really progressive things happening. So
yeah, I mean, I think we are going to see, and maybe, I mean, this won't be the peak of the mental health problems that come out of this. They'll come in a year to 18 months when people realise, hopefully we will be through it in a year to 18 months. And then people begin to deal with how it was rather than just being in crisis mode. But the more we can talk now, the more we save ourselves from shoring up that pain later.
Absolutely.
And I say that to somebody who has had cancer twice, and both times I did it wrong, in inverted commas, in that I kept going and I carried on. And it wasn't wrong at the time, but it did mean that I had to deal with a lot more emotional stuff afterwards.
Yeah.
And maybe if I'd have allowed myself to deal with more of the emotional stuff in the process of being physically ill as well, maybe I would have come out of it sooner. Don't know for sure, but I'm absolutely now an advocate for acknowledging the emotional toll as well as the physical toll.
No, absolutely. It goes back to what you were saying about we're all in the same sea, and so whereas your journey, and obviously you had, I'm sure you knew other people that were ill as well, but now we're all in it, aren't we? So actually it's a little bit easier, as you wisely said earlier, to have that conversation.
Yeah.
Just before, I want to sort of go back to sort of talking about glimmers of light at the moment. Before I go on, just because I want people to be able to join in if they're listening, could you talk a bit about, because I'm really interested in your adaptation or your sort of response to the current, as an artist, to the pandemic. And can you talk a bit about Tiny Revolutions?
Yeah, sure. We did launch for Fun Palaces this year on March the 17th, and we were supposed to have been in Inverness with all of our ambassadors and loads of Fun Palaces makers from all over the country, and we cancelled it with 2 days' notice, and we didn't launch from Inverness, which was kind of heartbreaking, because the idea of bringing people all the way from Cornwall to Inverness and from Northern Ireland to Inverness was, we were so excited by that. Truly showing, because we've got this funding from lottery which has enabled us to have these amazing ambassadors, and really, you know, in not London, thank God, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's not that there's anything wrong with London either. I mean, you and I both live here, and we also know that all of London certainly doesn't benefit from, you know, the small swathes of privilege that are here. However, getting out of the metropolises, getting, you know, bringing people together from lots of different parts of the UK was really thrilling to us, and it was our first really big meeting, and it didn't happen. And literally that day, I was sitting in the Fun Palace's office going, okay, so, and our office is at the Albany in Deptford, in what is also the Albany's meeting room quite often. Sitting there saying, okay, so it is possible that come October, we might be allowed to all be together, or we might not. We don't know. And we're launching anyway. So what can we offer people? And we've always said, as I explained earlier, that the Fun Palace is about the process, not the product. And it's, and so we've talked about Fun Palaces as being tiny revolutions of connection. Mm-hmm. Because connection is everything. And it's the connections you make that may take 3 years to blossom, or 10, or 6 weeks, who knows, or 2 days, 2 hours. We don't know, but it's tiny connections. And each connection is a revolution. And it's not a top-down thing. And it grows by people making their own little connections. Mm-hmm. And so combining that with an awareness of the perfectly understandable but slightly frustrating response from the arts sector, which was to throw everything online and make all of the resources digital. Which, you know, it's lovely that you can see a play that maybe you couldn't have seen unless you were in London, or you know, go to a I don't know, go visit a museum that you couldn't see unless you were in Manchester and see them online. That's all lovely. And I don't mean to say it doesn't matter. Of course it does. And, you know, some organisations have been deeply generous. However, we know from an Office of National Statistics 2018 study that 5 million people in the UK have never used the internet.
Yeah.
Not don't have access to it, but have never used it.
Yeah.
There's another around 7 million that have very little or no access unless they go to a library, all closed, go to a cafe, all closed. There's so many families where they might have one method of digital communication in the household, and now you've got people trying to work from home, you've got kids trying to study from home. It's just not useful for everyone to throw everything online. So, and because we know that even though online fun palaces have happened and they've been great, but the real connections happen when people get together over a cup of tea or a beer, we said, okay, well, let's try and share ideas for people to get together, and we'll try and make at least two-thirds of them offline. Mm-hmm. And so we called them Tiny Revolutions, because it's about tiny revolutions of connection. And in the first week, I think I put about 10 out. I think I've got about 25 or 30 on the site now. But two-thirds of them are things you can do offline.
Lovely.
And in the past fortnight, I've made PDFs for all of the ones that you can download individually as a PDF and maybe put through your neighbour's door for them to try. Or we've now done a larger PDF that I update whenever I've got a new one that I can fit into one A4 page with some photos and step-by-step how to do it. We've been sending them out. So a couple of community groups have said, you know, can you print some for us, and we'll put them into our care packages that we're delivering to vulnerable or isolated people. They're quite different. Some of them would require you to have a bit of bravery and try and, you know, make a game with the other neighbours on the balconies of your estate, so you're keeping social distance. Some of them don't need any bravery at all. They're just, you know, chalking a nice message on the pavement. Some of them are more arty. Some of them are just more about, you know, a different way to say hello to people. So there's lots of different versions, some more community-led, some more creative-led. But we think there's enough of a variety so far to be quite useful. And I'm printing them up from my little home printer, which is quite slow. But it's okay. And I ordered a whole bunch more big A4 envelopes. And, I mean, I was really excited when some people started saying, can you print us some? I was like, yes, of course. How brilliant. Because they're doing the work. They're doing the deliveries. All I'm doing is sitting at home getting on with some other work. And, you know, my printer's getting red hot. That's totally fine. But the really thrilling bit is that strangers have now started sending us their tiny revolutions.
Yeah,
and that really excites me.
I had a similar realisation, rather, Stella, because I was just about to start a new theatre project with a group of people in sheltered housing, literally the day pretty much. So I had the same as you. I was like, okay, few of them have access to the internet, but they don't like being creative in that way. That's not there generally. And so we designed the whole thing that we're kind of doing this postal creative course in them. So kind of similar, right? I'm sure, similar ideas, some of them as well. But it was a real, I don't think I was aware until I started thinking about it. Then I became aware of actually how common it is. Exactly what you said, those statistics, that actually people aren't online necessarily. It's also really it's really good fun sticking things through people's letterbox. It's fun, and it's really fun getting them, because usually you get pizza leaflets or bills, don't you?
Yes, but there's also something, there's something about the tactile, and this goes back to me saying to you, when you teach me a thing and we're using our hands,
yeah,
or actually people often teach dance or football skills and stuff like that in a fun palace, so, but we're using our bodies. There's something about using the body. And it's not, I mean, you know, I'm using my body now to talk to you. I'm waving my hands around. I'm using my mouth. But physically using the hands, picking something up, reading it, maybe running your fingers over it, that kind of access is something that goes, you know, I think it's quite primal in us as people. Mm-hmm. And at a time of great anxiety, it is quite nice to go back to things that we understand on a more physical level.
Yeah.
The other thing that I think is that, yes, I get why some organisations are saying, "All right, well, let's just give everyone tablets." You know, I don't think we should force people into being digital adepts if they don't want to.
No.
You know, it should be really okay for the people who don't want to be online to stay offline. And it really worries me that if digital access is seen as the only solution to social isolation, that what we're missing is the possibility that there are some people who just aren't going to jump, and nor should they have to. And it should be okay for all of us to say, I can do 2 hours a day online, but I can't do four, or I can do half an hour, but I can't do more, or I can do 10 minutes, or none. And that ought to be all right. And we, the arts organisations or the community organisations, need to find ways to support those people too, because they count as well.
Yeah, and it's also, it's extremely anxiety-inducing for a lot of people as well. That degree, you know, even people I know who are suddenly, half of their work used to be online and half of it would be face-to-face, and suddenly all of it is, and they are having really struggling with sort of mental health, insomnia, because it, you know...
Yes, it's exhausting. Yeah. I mean, it's really tiring. All of us who've turned to Zoom and Skype meetings, we're more tired.
Yeah. I mean, I had a day today, I was just like, I can't do this today, and I let myself off the hook, actually. It was the first day. I just thought, oh, my dog's... I don't know what she's doing. She turned into an attack dog. there's a lot of animal noises in the garden.
Animal noises are lovely, though. They show that we're live.
Oh, no, it's great. The garden's full of creatures and super. That's a nice thing. Which nice. I'll make sure that all the information about you and Tiny Revolutions and everything else that you're doing is on the podcast and on the... be lovely to get even more people involved. But actually, my dog barking and talking about animal noises sort of leads me to what I wanted to talk to you about, which was... I'm sort of on a personal level. Well, you as an artist and as a human person.
Yeah.
I'm also interested in looking at, amongst the loss and the grief, of which there is lots, and that's not to be ignored or dismissed, or diminished in any way. There are lots, I think, of glimmers of light and hope. Yeah. And I wondered if you had noticed anything sort of professionally or personally, things that seem better at this time, and anything that has made you... Stella, I think I'd quite like to keep hold of that change when this is over. I don't want to go back to before.
I go away for work a lot, and it's really useful and it's really important, being one of the people running an organisation, that I go, that we all do, we travel a lot for Fun Palaces, that we go and visit the people who are making Fun Palaces. And that's so important to the core of what we do. And it's not led by somebody in an office who doesn't know who's doing the work. And that's one of the reasons I think it's been successful, because we honestly personally know the people. However, it has been really nice to be at home for a bit. Honest it has.
Yeah.
To not have to pack a bag, to not have to think, oh, okay, so Thursday and Friday nights, so I won't see Shelley, my wife. Mm-hmm. All right, so what will I take with me? You know, we've been together 30 years this year.
Wow. Congratulations.
Thank you. These 4 or 5 weeks, you know, I'm not sure we've had this much time, just the two of us, since we were very newly together and we couldn't bear to be in anyone else's company because we were so much in love.
Yeah.
And I'm very fortunate, I think, in that because I'm training in psychotherapy at the moment, I've found thinking about myself and my reactions much more interesting, and brilliantly, so is Shelley. She's been finding what I'm studying really interesting too.
Oh.
And that's really good luck, because of course she may have just thought, well, that's your thing, not mine, and I'm not interested. So we've had this amazing sort of resurgence after all this time of being interested. Not that we've been bored with each other, but this is a different kind of interest.
Yeah.
And I'm feeling really grateful for that. And I, you know, when you're studying therapy, you have to be in therapy.
Yeah.
But I would want to anyway, because I think it's really weird to try and do something for people and not experience it yourself. But I was saying to my therapist a couple of weeks ago that this time, the conversations that Shelley and I are having are like both the times that I had cancer. They're like when my mum died. They're like when her sister died and she was looking after her a lot. They're conversations around things that we care about passionately, but they're not huge, deep conversations. They're sort of light and they're in passing, and they'll get deeper and they'll get lighter. But I'm saying this, you know, thinking also of friends with 3 small kids and how it's so different in their houses. Mm-hmm. And I totally get that. But for us, that's been such a bonus. And I do value the importance of going away from home and meeting the people who do the work that we work with. We couldn't have created Fun Palaces if it was just in our heads and we didn't know the people who do it, but I am loving being at home. Yeah. The other thing I'm really liking is not getting the tube.
Yeah.
And I'm an absolute adorer of London. You know, I was born in South London. We moved to New Zealand when I was 5. My mum was a South Londoner. Most of my siblings have never lived anywhere else, although I have a sister who lives in Spain now, and one who lived in Greece, but she's back. London is in our heart and our soul and our spirit, and I love it. And that means I love the tube as well. But it is quite nice not getting any public transport at the moment. And again, not being a key worker, of course it's a privilege for me to be able to say that. Mm. I can do pretty much everything I do from home. Of course I know how fortunate that is. But it is really nice not to spend 2 to sometimes 3 hours a day travelling, you know.
It's interesting hearing you talk. Oh, all of those things chime absolutely with me. Really interesting and beautiful to hear you talk as well, because one thing that's happened in the last couple of weeks when I've been having conversations about this is people, and you've done it the whole way through our conversations, are very aware that their situation is in everyone's situation, and we have become even more grateful to each other and even yes. more sort of gentle with each other and understanding. And so everybody is answered with, well, this is true for me, but I appreciate that that's not everyone else's situation.
Yeah.
And I found that, Stella, hugely encouraging. Not that the people that I know or have spoken to are selfish people. They're not at all. But that feels heightened. And for me, mm-hmm. that's an enormously hopeful thing.
Yeah.
That we're reminded of each other's suffering as well as each other's privilege, as well as, you know, all of it. That feels, I don't know, that does feel like a hopeful thing.
Totally. And there is I've been actually really busy these past 5 weeks, partly because of study, and that's just moved entirely online, partly because I'm starting to do some placements, so I've had lots of trainings for that, and that's fantastic, and I've really appreciated the value of extra training, and partly because Fun Palaces and Tiny Revolutions has taken a lot of time, and that's really exciting. But even with that being almost more busy than normal, because of not spending a lot of time travelling, and, you know, it is a particularly London, although I guess other really big cities, I don't know, Washington, New York might be similar, Sao Paulo probably, no doubt. Because of that extra time, instead of, you know, walking almost all the way from Loughborough Junction to Deptford, mm-hmm. as my exercise, I'm walking around the park, or I'm not walking around the park because it's too busy, and I'm a bit worried about being in a very busy park, so I'm walking around the edges of the park. I'm seeing people's gardens come into blossom. I'm spending a little bit more time in my garden. I did yoga in my garden at this time today. And it's a little 40-foot garden, but that's loads of room for at least 8 yoga mats.
You can do a very large downward-facing dog with that.
A huge downward-facing dog. And so that kind of, I just feel there is deep good fortune for me at this time when I look at that. And on my harder days, and I think we're all having good days and bad days, it's a little bit harder for me to look at that. And I'm not very good at that. I've really practiced, and it comes from being an improviser, and saying yes and trying to do the positive thing and trying to do. And I'm learning at 57. That just letting it be and letting myself be not okay today or anxious today or not capable of going for a walk, even though it's a lovely day, letting that be means that I can experience that emotion, the difficulty, as well. And somehow it allows the joyous stuff to come, not instead, but maybe with a stronger piquancy. Yeah. You know, I've read that stuff. I've been practicing Buddhism for over 30 years. I've read that stuff loads of times. I've understood it as a concept, but the reason it's called a Buddhist practice and a yoga practice, because I've also trained in yoga teaching in the past year, is because that's really hard to do. It's really hard for human beings to be. We're not very skilled at it, most of us, and we can spend lifetimes practicing being.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so right now, where there's a lot of lack of option. I don't have the option to go out to a movie. I don't have the option to go out for dinner. I don't have the option to go and meet a colleague instead of having a phone call with them. In some ways, that restricting of options and letting that be is allowing some other things to open.
Yeah.
And I'm learning. Learning. I think it might be a lifetime's work for me, but I'm learning to let it be.
But that's okay as well, isn't it? It's okay for it to take us our whole lives because it's a beautiful thing. So, I wanted to ask you, just because I'm investigating hope and I'm interested in active hope. So I don't, you know, I'm not thinking about wishing on a star and stuff, but sort of active hope. And this might be too bigger question to answer, or maybe not in these strange times. But where do you find hope? And I'm aware that's a big question, but I'm also thinking about the way that we feel. Certainly pre-pandemic, it felt like we were hemmed in, all of us, by terrible climate news. Donald Trump, you know, the terrible division that Brexit brought all of us and broke people up, and then this. And I wondered if you do feel hopeful about the future, and obviously, again, not, you don't have to say you are if you don't. And if you do feel hopeful, where that hope comes from for you?
I actually want to cry even thinking about this.
Oh.
It's good, right?
Yeah,
it's fine.
Yeah.
So I'm training in existential psychotherapy, and existential psychotherapy really acknowledges the hard stuff.
Yeah.
That we are all going to die, the mortality, the fact that in the darkest moments we are lonely. You know, it is just lonely. No one else can really know your pain, and that there will be times when we are alone, and that, you know, others can't make it better, and sometimes we can't make it better either. And existential psychotherapy and philosophy talks about finding meaning. So Albert Camus, and I only read this last year because a friend of mine, a dear, really important friend that I've been friends with since I was 12, killed herself.
Oh, and gosh, I'm sorry, Stella.
Thank you. It was so hard for all of us who loved her. I mean, it still is. It's not even a year yet. And it was suggested that I read The Myth of Sisyphus, which is Camus' existential piece. And Sisyphus is condemned by, I can't remember which god, but a god, for mocking somebody or something, upsetting the gods somehow, to roll a rock up a hill every day. And he gets to the top and then it just rolls down. And he has to do it again and again and again.
I've written about him in my book because he's...
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'll send you the link to a program I heard which focused on him a lot. Because he's... I mean, his story has sort of fascinated and challenged generations of philosophical thinkers.
Yes.
Both religious thinkers and secular thinkers. So yeah. I'm very fond of Sisyphus.
That's so cool. But so what Camus says in this, and I mean, it's pretty challenging because he does say, well, yeah, in many ways of thinking, maybe taking your own life is the sensible choice. Maybe it is. You know, maybe you can't go on. Maybe, and he says, all of that is true. And also, there is this possibility that you can find meaning in even just pushing the rock up the hill.
Mm-hmm.
It is possible that meaning can be found in simply pushing, knowing, even when you know that the rock is going to roll down again and you will spend all day tomorrow rolling the rock up the hill. Because, and this is partly, I mean, this is partly the problem of capitalism, right? Capitalism says, if you work, you'll get more things and better. That's simply not the truth of every life. My mum and dad both had to leave school at 14, both had rotten wars, both were in the services. My dad was a prisoner of war for 4.5 years. It was just all hard. And then they died with no money and they worked really hard all their lives. And some people work hard all their lives and they never make loads of money and great comfort. It just doesn't happen, you know. And they weren't even particularly worried about making loads of money. It wasn't about that for them. It was about having options and choices for their kids, for me, that they never had, having had to leave school at 14. And I'm the one youngest of seven who got those chances in many ways that my older siblings didn't either, because there simply wasn't enough money with so many kids and because we weren't a rich family. But even so, my parents found value in finding meaning in the lives they had. And capitalism has led us this lie that says, work really hard, and when you push your rock up the hill, you're going to get this amazing thing. Well, that's simply not true of every life. And in the end, is that amazing thing worth it anyway? And maybe the meaning and the place of hope is to be found in getting up and making your kids breakfast, or going out for your walk and smiling at your neighbour because you're living by yourself and your neighbour's living by yourself. And actually, you had a huge argument 10 years ago, but you could probably manage to nod this morning.
Yeah.
And it's the tiny connections that I think are hopeful. And thinking about our dear friend and that she couldn't find that connection that night. And, you know, had it been a different night, she might have made a different choice.
Yeah.
And that... those connections are where I see hope in the darkest times. And I think that the possibility of making small connections is everything.
Yeah, me too.
And that's what I'm seeing at the moment. And it really does. I feel so tearful saying this because that's the core of humanity. Not can we build another bloody skyscraper and not can we, you know, win another war and not even can we solve the problem of the virus by getting the vaccine in 6 weeks, because of course that would be great, but let's not forget that we are doing astonishing work daily right now by making tiny connections with other people as we pass them in the street. Mm. And that's enormous. Enormous.
I agree. I mean, I don't, again, I'm being honest about everything that has come up and all of the losses, but I honestly think that this virus has given us many gifts. It's reminded us to be grateful. It has reminded us of the importance and the depth of our connections and interconnections.
Yes.
And those feel like a huge gift.
They are a huge gift, and we need to build on them.
Yeah.
So if and when this all stops, we don't just clap for the key workers on a Thursday night. We make sure they're getting paid properly.
Yeah, exactly. That's what my sister said. She said, it's nice getting clapped, but I'd really like sufficient PPE and a pay rise.
Absolutely. You know, we don't ever let that happen, you know, that appalling dereliction of duty that this government has done to the NHS for the past 10, 15 years. We don't ever let that happen again.
No.
We make sure that we are out on the streets making that difference, and we keep up the tiny acts of connection.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, you know, they say it takes, what, 10 weeks or 40 days or something like that, so it's between 40 and 70 days to change a habit, we may be well in the process of changing our habits right now. And if we are aware of that, and if we pay attention to the fact that we're connecting a bit more, and we pay attention to the fact that we're not just grateful for the NHS, but we want to protect and culture it, then it might well be that, yes, the losses are going to be huge. And yes, there is going to be dues to pay around people's mental health after this, but those gains won't be lost. And what's really important is we are careful about maintaining the gains.
Yeah, I've lots of hope about that, because I think one of the things that makes me hopeful, which sounds like I mean this in a generous way, is that I know that people will have gained pleasure from it. And when people gain pleasure, they're more likely to want to carry on doing it. So, I mean, you know, for example, you get a little endorphin rush, you get a little bit of oxytocin, serotonin, you know, all of that stuff, all of those beautiful hormones going on because you've helped, because you've smiled, because you've said hello. And those will help support it, as well as people wanting to. They've also, I am encouraged by the fact that people are telling me they're enjoying it.
Yes.
And that
makes it go in on a different level.
Yeah.
And it makes us want to repeat it.
Yeah, exactly. You're like, that felt nice. Yeah. I'm going to do that. I'm going to do that nice thing again. The thing that makes me feel like chocolate, I'm going to do that. Oh,
that's brilliant.
So beautiful talking to you. Thank you so much.
Absolutely gorgeous.
That's lovely. And I hope very much that you and I will have a nice Deptford cup of tea.
Oh, a big hug.
Yeah, and a massive hug. My friend was saying, she said, oh, wouldn't it be incredible if we could like build a machine, some sort of crazy steampunk machine, so that when it's over and everyone hugs and everyone parties, all that energy could be used instead of fossil fuels. I just love the idea of making this kind of Tim Burton kind of hug energy generating machine. Should we do that?
Let's do that. That's very fun.
Before we go, I just want to make sure that people know, well, I will put it in the copy as well, but I just wondered if you could talk about how we can find you, how we could join in, where's the best sort of first stop place for people to go if they want to join in.
Online, it's funpalaces.co.uk. Mm-hmm. If you happen to be not online, my phone number, my actual phone number, we don't have work phone numbers, my phone number is in our contact details. So somebody else would have to go online for you, but my phone number is in our contact details. You can give me a call and I'll talk to you about how to make a fun palace, or you can tell me what tiny revolutions you're doing and I'll write it up and I'll share it online and post it back to you. We talked about this and it was like, do I put my phone number out there? It's like, well, I haven't got another phone, and why not, you know?
Yeah, it's very generous. Yeah, generous and great. So more fun, more palaces.
And more tiny revolutions.
And more tiny revolutions. Yeah. Stella, thank you so much for your time. Much love.
Thanks so much for this lovely conversation.
I look forward to a massive hug.
Me too.
Speaking with lovely Stella, I looked up Joan Littlewood and I found this quote. She said, "If we don't get lost, we'll never find a new route." So maybe it's a good thing after all that we did get or have been a little bit lost each other, disconnected. And now, as you know, I like to invite you to take a little action every week on the back of the conversation that I've had with someone. And I'd like to invite you to try a tiny little revolution of your own. Stella and I talked about the importance of connectivity. So if you have time and the inclination this week, just try and make a tiny little connection with your neighbour or someone passing you in the street at a distance, or reach out and make a phone call to someone you haven't spoken to for a while. And all those tiny connections will build up until we've found our way back to each other again. Thank you for listening.